Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you through the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because of we have with us tonight one of my favorite guests. His name is Colonel Roberts, and, of course, he's retired a military. He spent 20-some years working with the military. He was in Vietnam. He's written, at least 10 or 11 books, a number of which we carry, Doorway to Hell, The Medusa File, The Dead Witnesses, Kill Zone, a Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza. But tonight we're going to be talking about a subject which is so important, and that is what's really going on in America today. Are we really fighting a war on terrorism, or are we fighting a war against the American people and using terrorism as a vehicle of ever-increasing government control of our lives? Craig, thanks so much for being with us.
Always glad to be back, Dr. Stan.
Well, tell us what your take is on what's going on today.
Well, there's just so many things that are just coming together all at once. And ever since 9/11, it seems like things have just snowballed. There's so many laws that have been passed. There's so much security that's been put in place, not only at airports, but in all kinds of other things that are going on. And at the same time, we're getting involved in all kinds of things overseas to where we're sending so many American troops and airplanes and ships and equipment, out of the country that it's getting a little bit scary here at home because we don't know who's watching the chickens. You know, this is one of the most precarious times that I've seen in my lifetime, and that includes my year in Vietnam.
Well, of course, I think the thing is most people don't understand that we've got most of our army overseas. We've got a good deal of our reserves. We're sending our National Guard. We're calling them up. If there was unrest in America, if there should be, and let's hope and pray there's not, but a biological or other form of terrorist attack here at home, there was chaos in the streets, a financial collapse. I mean, where would we get the stability here? Would we perhaps have to bring in foreign troops? People say that could never happen in America, but, when you try to understand why we're really going to war with Iraq, there are a lot of unanswered questions there, aren't there?
Oh, there is that, indeed. In fact, you know, what we need to do is go back a little bit in history and just put all the cards on the table so everybody can see what we're dealing with right now. If we go back into the Clinton administration, we saw a total reduction of our military. Basically, the military was destroyed from 1990 on after Desert Storm and the fall of the Soviet Union. The excuses were all in place to downbuild the military. And the Clinton administration closed bases, reduced the troop strength and the divisions, reduced the divisions in sizes or in numbers, took planes out of squadrons, reduced the squadrons from 18 to 16 planes.
I'm going to have to interrupt you right there. We're going to be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and right now we have with us our special guest, Colonel Craig Roberts. And Craig has been talking about, what's happened during the Clinton administration and the downsizing of our military. You pick up the story from there, Craig.
Well, we had all of these things happening, from after Desert Storm to where they started reducing our troop strength and they're letting equipment go into disrepair. They're having to cannibalize tanks to keep other tanks running, and the same thing with airplanes. We had F-16 sitting on the ground with no engines. All of these things are going on. The same thing that had happened to Russia previous to this, almost by design. And it was at this time, just a few years ago, that Barry McGaffrey, General Barry McGaffrey, who was the commander of SOCOM in Florida and later became Clinton's drug czar, had gone to CASQ, which is the Command and Staff Preparation School at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and talked to the graduating class there, of which I had a young nephew in who was a two-tour Somali veteran, a young captain, West Point graduate. And he was educated very well on several things that I'd brought him up to understand in the ways of the world. And when McGaffrey was introduced as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, my young nephew started taking copious notes. Immediately after the lecture, he called me and says, "You're not going to believe what this guy said." And I said, "Well, tell me about it." He said, "Because of the build down in our armed forces," and I love that word, build down.
That means instead of build up, it's build down. Yeah. Intentional, purposeful, malicious build down.
That's right. It says, "Because of the build down, should we get committed overseas in an extensive campaign or a two-front war, we will have to use our troops that are in this country overseas, and we will be called upon to use, should a national emergency occur inside the continental United States, we'll be forced to call upon foreign assets to police our streets."
And, of course, most people wouldn't even realize what he's talking about, but, of course, your nephew recognized right away he's talking about foreign troops.
Absolutely. He's talking about United Nations troops policing the streets of America. And people say, "Well, they can't do that." Well, absolutely they can, because that's exactly what they've been doing all over the world for a number of years now, using American troops in other countries as well. They've got to realize that while all of these other things have been going on, we've been stationing troops in such places as Macedonia, Kosovo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Colombia, Afghanistan, South Korea, and dozens of other places. And now we're committing troops to Turkey, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, staging them for an invasion of Iraq.
No, according to Ron Paul, we have our troops in 140 nations throughout the world. And we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Colonel Greg Roberts. And I think you'll find this a fascinating, fascinating program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Colonel Craig Roberts is with us this evening. He's retired from the military reserve and certainly a long, long time a police officer in Vietnam as well, but a writer, a lecturer, and certainly one of our favorite guests. And we've been talking about really what's happened to the America military. It's been intentionally decreased in numbers. They've been building down our military as part of this whole idea of eventually doing away with militaries throughout the world and creating this one world order, a new world religion. But in the process, of course, why, of course, we go from war to war, and now we're certainly entering another major international conflict. We have our troops stationed in 140 nations throughout the world. Many of those countries were keeping dictators in power. But, of course, should there be a crisis at home, why, at least according to Greg, General Barry McGaffney had actually told a group of military officers, it would be necessary then to bring in foreign assets. Pick up the story there, Craig.
Well, at the same time all of this stuff is going on, they've been calling up, we've worn the active duty people out. The troop morale was not very in very good shape prior to being deployed to Iraq, and now, of course, the morale's built back up because of Afghanistan and because of going into Iraq, and everybody's going to be patriotic and do this sort of thing. But they're going in there with equipment that still needs parts, still needs repair, still needs support. We got ships that belong in the yards to go get overhauled, and they're at sea right now. And we've got a situation where the reserves are being called up as individuals and as units. And they're being deployed in both combat support roles, plus backfill in Germany and Korea and other countries. Plus, National Guard units are now being activated. And we never saw this, since the Korean War, of National Guard units being activated in total and sent overseas.
We had a couple of military officers, pilots now, who are being tried for dropping a bomb on a Canadian unit in Afghanistan. And certainly what they did is a terrible, terrible tragedy. But apparently the military had been forcing these officers to take amphetamines to keep awake, to keep flying, because of the shortage of pilots that we have. And now, of course, the terrible tragedies occurred. And I think tragedies occur in war, but I think these men are going to be scapegoated. And the major thing, I think, is to cover up the fact that they're forcing our pilots to take the drugs which in America we consider illegal.
Well, absolutely. And this is a practice that's gone on for years. Every time we have to take fighter squadrons across the Atlantic, they fly at nighttime. They want to keep these guys awake for, 8 or 12 hours or however long it takes to fly alongside a tanker, because an F-16 can't fly from, Dover Air Force Base to England nonstop. It has to have a tanker, so it can't fly as fast as it can. It has to fly the tanker speed, which takes a number of hours. So what they do just before they take off is they give them what they call go pills, which are amphetamines. And these squadrons that have been flying Northern Watch and Southern Watch over Iraq all of these years since the Gulf War are basically Air National Guard squadrons from around the country. And, these are the guys that have to leave home and go do this sort of thing, because the regular Air Force can't handle all the missions anymore. We're seeing more actual frontline combat roles being passed on to reserves and National Guard. And we've also got individual volunteers being accepted and also getting little cards in the mail saying, you will report. And now they're even contacting retired personnel and asking them if they're willing to volunteer for backfill in the United States. We've got Army National Guard units right now being activated to go through training to guard the air bases and Air National Guard bases here, while everybody else departs for overseas. It's stripping us down to the point to where we don't hardly have anybody left. Now, at the same time all of this is going on, we've got North Korea looking very closely at crossing the border to South Korea and threatening to use nuclear weapons on us if we try to interfere. At exactly the same time, China has been moving all of its troops and forces up to the coastline of the Straits of Formosa, looking at Taiwan. They've already held exercises to see if they could reach Taiwan with their missiles, which they can. And they've had ships out there patrolling and showing the flag in front of Taiwan, trying to scare the Taiwanese for, 2 or 3 years now. And they've told us that if we try to interfere, that they would use missiles on our carrier groups, which we're not going to have any carrier groups there because everything's been deployed to the Gulf and to the Mediterranean. So we're stretched very thin right now. China is just waiting for us to get involved in Iraq, and at the same time we're involved in Afghanistan, and now the Afghanis are doing exactly the same thing that they did during the three different British invasions of Afghanistan. They don't offer that much resistance up front. They wait several months, up to a year, before they start their counterattacks, when everybody's kind of dropped their guard and then been committed in other places and can't reinforce who they've already got over there. And we're seeing that today. Just outside of Kabul and Kandahar, there was a couple of attacks today. And a helicopter crashed over there. We don't know if it was shot down or not. But these are the things that happen in Afghanistan after a period of time that's elapsed, and then the guerrillas reform and reattack. Meanwhile, while all of this is going on, we've got China, which now controls the Panama Canal, thanks to Jimmy Carter, and has several hundred thousand troops stationed in Panama. They have the largest ocean transshipment port in the world in Freeport in the Bahamas, just 55 miles from Miami.
Craig, did you say they have several hundred thousand troops stationed in Panama?
Between Panama and some of the other spots around the world right now, they've got several hundred thousand Chinese troops.
You mean in the Bahamas and those other areas where they have these large freight depots or what?
Right, and also in the Sudan and a few other places. But the thing about it is, what we're most worried about is Costco, which is the China Ocean Shipping Company, has set up the largest ocean transshipment port in the world in Freeport. And this is their Diego Garcia, this is their forward deployment port. If you just get on the internet and look up Costco, Freeport, Bahamas, it'll show you photographs of these huge cranes for loading ships. They've got airfields They've got piles of these sea lift containers that are as big as semi-trucks that are 5, 6, 7 deep. We don't know what's in them, but we do know that some of those sea lift containers in the last 2-3 years have been intercepted coming into this country, and inside they found AK-47s, RPD machine guns, mines and explosives, and all kinds of stuff. Now, the shipment that they caught in Long Beach, California, they tried to pass off as somebody was smuggling in arms to Los Angeles street gangs. And, you know, that's just a layer on the onion. That's nothing more than a cover story, because there's no way street gangs could buy sea lift containers full of Chinese, brand new Chinese arms. Those things were being positioned someplace for a reason. And then the story went away. I talked to a friend of mine that was with Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office at the time, and he said that as soon as they came up with this street gang story, all of a sudden everybody was told not to talk about it anymore. It would just go away. Well, then they intercepted another container in San Diego. They intercepted one near Houston, Texas, Galveston, Texas. And then rumor has it they even got one in New Jersey, but I could never follow up on that. I couldn't get anybody to talk about that one.
So, and of course, we know that the Chinese have these very very rich oil holdings over in the Sudan, and of course they raised the money to develop the oil there in American financial markets. That was China Petrol along with a Canadian company, and then of course they develop the oil, they give the money to the Sudanese government, and they use it to quell the Christians of the South. So basically, the money that's being used to kill the Christians came from our financial markets through the China Petrol to the Sudanese government. And where is the outcry here about rising money here in the United States for this sort of an atrocity? And of course, it's deafening in its silence.
Oh, absolutely. And then, you know, we look at the oil thing. At the same time, we can't leave out the drug trade, because what we have now is not only international drug smuggling, but narco-terrorism, because a lot of the narcotic smuggling finances the terrorist organizations. If you look at just Colombia alone, you've got the Medellin and Cali cartels, but, you know, these drug lords don't go out and grow and harvest cocaine leaves. They buy it from the locals that live out in the outback, who are supported by guerrilla armies such as Shining Path and the Freedom Light and all of these other guys out there. They own parts of Colombia. The government won't even hardly go into those places because their army is better equipped and better financed than the government troops. That's why the American troops and helicopters have been sent down there. But these things have been coming through. The cocaine out of Colombia has been coming through since, you know, back before Iran-Contra. If we look at the Middle East, we see that the heroin shipments, the opium shipments that have been coming out of the Middle East, come out of Turkey, comes out of Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq. And with Iraq closed down to shipments, that cuts off not only oil but opium. When the Mujahideen ran the Russians out of Afghanistan, the opium crop started up again until the Taliban came in. And when the Taliban came in, they shut it down as fundamentalists, but the Northern Alliance tribes up in the northeast part, northeast of Kabul and east over into Pakistan and the Khyber Pass and Fort Sherman and that area, their trade has always been growing opium, and they were trying to get the opium crop out, but they couldn't do it very well because the Taliban was in power. But once we got the Taliban out of there, all of a sudden the opium crop springs right back up again.
Now, it's really so strange that we would, of course, take out the Taliban in the name of capturing Osama bin Laden, which we didn't capture. And then, of course, we would then get the opium crop going again. And you can't help but wonder, maybe, of course, our war on drugs is not really as much of a war on drugs as it is a war to use drugs to raise funds for CIA covert operations.
Well, the war on drugs is basically the war on competition. We have elements within our own government that have been running this stuff ever since World War II, when we had an OSS team in the Golden Triangle area of Burma that was basically in charge of running drugs out to the Corsican Mafia and other places to finance the Kuomintang Army under Chiang Kai-shek to fight the Japanese and Mao Zedong at the same time.
We're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, Colonel Craig Roberts. All right. Well, our guest this evening is Craig Roberts, and of course we're talking about, well, we're basically talking about what's going on in the world. And if you find it difficult to believe that, of course, there really is a connection between the CIA and drugs, why you really should get the books written by Rodney Stitz, Defrauding America and Drugging America. And of course, he had an opportunity to interview many of the CIA agents who tried to come forward and tell the truth. And of course, you find it difficult to get those books, but if you're interested in them, you can always call our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927, and the report, and the certainly the operators can tell you how to get those books. Drugging America, Defrauding America, our four tapes. Yet, is there really a war on drugs? And the truth of the matter is, if we're trying to stop the drugs, we're doing a terrible job. If we're trying to convince the American people we're trying to stop the influx of drugs and we're really actually encouraging it, then we're doing a great, great job. And, of course, that's covered in another book called Into the Buzzsaw, with an interview with a gentleman named Gary Webb, who had written about the CIA and drug involvement, and he will tell you the CIA investigated it, their inspector general, and it was far worse than in his articles that appeared in the San Jose Mercury. So pick it up from there, Craig.
Well, it's you know, there's so much of this that's been going on for so long, and every time somebody tries to blow the whistle on this on the inside, they either get arrested, they have an accident, they commit suicide, or they end up in prison, or they're totally discredited. You know, the old trick is discredit, debunk, or destroy.
Yeah, of course, it's like calling Rush Limbaugh and telling him that you think that the Council on Foreign Relations is part of a move to create a world government. He will demonize you, he will ridicule you, but then, of course, so will O'Reilly, so will all of these so-called conservatives that are, well, I like to call them the best conservatives money can buy. Go ahead. But it's a standard technique. Anybody talks about the CIA and drugs, they get exactly the same treatment.
Well, it goes back to Operation Monarch, Operation Mockingbird. Operation Mockingbird was the CIA putting editors in the publishing houses in New York City, the main publishers, and also in the radio stations and television stations to make sure certain information never saw the light of day. And if you're a journalist and you tried to bring any of this out, all of a sudden, you didn't have a job anymore.
Right. Well, that's, of course, this book we have. It's called Into the Buzzsaw. It's essays by 18 people within the media. One of them is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. A number of them get Emmys for their television work until, of course, they try to tell the truth. And at that point, why have they been placed into the buzzsaw? In other words, cut to pieces, demonized, and, of course, never again can get a job in the media, because what they want there is not people who tell the truth, but people who will avoid telling the truth, but give the American people that feeling of sincerity.
Well, you know, a prime example of censorship is I had written several books that had New York City mainstream publishers, and one of them became a bestseller, and we were really doing well. And then I wrote a book called Legacy of Dishonor, and I sent it to my agent, and he took it to 10 publishing houses in New York City, 2 in Washington, D.C., and after they looked at it, none of them would touch it. And he acted like, I don't know why this book won't sell, a 650-page manuscript of all kinds of great information that needs to be out there, but no one, you know, is interested in it. And so we sat around for about 30 days trying to figure out what to do next, and I got a call from a senior editor at Simon & Schuster, and he called me from his house on a weekend, and he said, you've got to get this information out.
Now, wait a minute. Hold on just a minute. We'll tell the rest of that story in just a moment here, because I want you to hear it. It's so vitally important to understand what's going on in America today. Well, our guest is Colonel Craig Roberts, and he was just telling us about a book that he had written, and of course it was taken to all of the major publishers there, and then of course on a weekend, why one of the people working in the editorial staff of a major publisher calls him, and what did he tell you, Craig?
Well, he said that, he said this Legacy of Dishonor book is tremendous. He says, you've got to get this information out to the American people. They have to see what's in this book. And I said, well, if it's so good, why can't you take it? He said, because I would lose my job. And I said, what are you talking about? He says, haven't you heard about, Project Mockingbird? And I said, no. He says, government controls what we say. They've got editors in all the publishing houses, and that's why I couldn't even call you from the office, because I don't even trust my own telephone. And so basically what I did is I ended up having to break the book down into two books and publish them separately myself, The first one came out. It was Kill Zone, which you carry. You know, a sniper looks at Dealey Plaza about the Kennedy assassination. But it goes much further than that. It goes back to 1773 and comes all the way forward past Vietnam. Then what was left over became the Medusa file. And while I was working on that, there were several other cases that I got involved in that ended up being included into the Medusa file. So those are the two books that that people in our own government did not want anybody to see because it exposed what was really going on behind the scenes in many, many cases and case files that we worked. And absolutely incredible that we had to do that. But since then, you know, we were able to go on with other information. And I think probably the scariest time was during the Clinton administration because, you know, I had my phones bugged, I was followed, my house was under surveillance, all kinds of things like that. And then after Bush went to Washington, a lot of that stuff ceased. And of course, the book's already been out, but it does disappear off of the computers at the main bookstores. And if people can't find it, the best way to do it, I guess, is go to Radio Liberty because you've always got it.
That's 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like to know how to get the book Medusa File or Kill Zone: A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza.
And meanwhile, you know, we started talking about China. We got to understand that we've also got reports of Chinese troops in Mexico. I don't know how many of them are down there. We keep hearing these rumors, but what we do have in Mexico is we have Arab terrorists that have been crossing the southwestern border with groups of illegal Mexican immigrants who have these coyotes that get paid money to escort illegals across the border all the way from Texas to California. It's wide open down there. And these Islamic terrorists are paying $10,000 apiece to cross the border, according to some of the people in Mexico who are down there. There was one man who owned a small hotel at one of the border villages on the Mexican side, and he said that he was afraid to even say anything to anybody because these guys were also paying off the federales and the Mexican troops and everything else, and were just down there with impunity.
Now, these are the Muslim terrorists you're talking about.
These are the Muslim terrorists that have been coming across the border.
That we're not trying to stop. And this is the incredible thing. We're really not trying to stop them.
We've got a wide-open border. We've got, you know, tens of thousands of people coming across all the time. The Border Patrol's absolutely overwhelmed. In fact, the Border Patrol has been reduced in size because when the Homeland Security Administration came into being, a lot of the Border Patrol people were allowed to lateral transfer into the new administration and almost doubled their salary. And so a lot of them just said, you know, we're not getting support on the border. No one cares about this anymore. I'm getting out of the desert, and I'm going to make more money, and I'm going to leave this. And so it's pretty much wide open to the point to where down in Tucson right now, you've got ranchers forming small armed groups to protect their own ranches, patrol the border themselves, and challenging the government to come down and stop them. Say, hey, we'll be glad to let you take over guarding the border if you'll just show up down here. Anybody that doesn't know what's going on, they can look it up on the Internet at the newspaper in Tucson. I think it's called the Tucson Tumbleweed.
Isn't it interesting? Of course, we could put the money out to build a barbed wire fence and barrier between Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, we got plenty of money for that, but we don't have enough money to build a fence along our own borders. Or maybe we really aren't trying to guard our borders. Maybe bringing in all these illegals from south of the border and even the terrorists is part of a different program. And we know that there are actually groups here financed by the Ford Foundation with the complete and tacit support of certain people on our government that are actually have formed organizations for people who are here illegally. And then, of course, the government, anytime they can, of course, makes them illegal and says, but it'll never happen again. It's no longer be a problem if we just give all these people American citizenship. Something's wrong with the picture. Go ahead. We've got about a minute here before we have
okay,
to...
Okay, I heard the music. I wasn't sure.
Okay, go ahead. No, you know, don't you worry.
and when we get back from the break, Dr. Stan, we need to tell the people about these 5,000 Iraqis that were brought into this country between 1993 and 1995 and settled all over the place.
All right, fine. And many of those, and some of those, certainly were involved with the Oklahoma City bombing, but the American people don't know. We'll be right back. And this is Dr. Stan coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when, of course, we want to remind you, Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and, of course, we do what we do because we are very, very seriously concerned about what's happening to America. So if you agree that there's a problem and you'd like to help us in what we do, and that is 5 hours every day we have about 50 stations now that carry some of our program. About 34 to 35 of those are on the weekend. They're only half an hour, but at least people across America hearing the truth. Now, many stations hear us, as they do in the Northwest every evening, here in the Central Coast of California, back in New York, in Tennessee. We have stations that carry our programs every day in Colorado. But of course, what we do is an expensive thing. So if you agree that there's a problem and you'd like to be part of an organization that is addressing that, we hope many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And if you'd like to contact us, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we also would hope that many of you would give serious consideration to telling others about our programs. Going to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com, and you can get our programs there. Many of these programs are archived. You can listen to them for several weeks. We archive 3 hours of our programs a day. The other 2 hours can be heard on links off of our website. But try to get other people to listen, and you certainly have our permission to copy our programs and distribute them either off the Internet or copy them when you hear them in the evening. We ask you to copy our newsletters, which are up on the Internet. Now, if any of you would like to get a free copy of our newsletters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll be most happy to send you a copy of our October newsletter. It's Kristen Breitweiser's testimony before the Senate Select Committee on intelligence at 18th of September of 2002, but it's really the story of what happened to her husband, Ron Breitweiser, on September 11th, 2001. He was in the South Tower, and she asked a number of questions, and of course, the questions are very, very important and very, very vital to what's going on. And of course, her testimony was totally censored by the controlled media. The television cameras were rolling. The reporters were there taking notes, but for one reason or another, the really important things she brought up were never brought out. She'll give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a free copy of the October newsletter. Call us at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and with us is Craig Roberts, certainly one of our favorite guests, and the author of The Medusa File, the author of The Kill Zone and The Doorway to Hell, co-author of that, and a number of books we carry, The Dead Witnesses. But, of course, my favorite is The Medusa File. I think it's probably one of the most important books we carry because it will give you such an overview of history, the things that you will never hear in the controlled media. And that's, of course, why the major publishers were not allowed to put this out. And this really is so true. We hear this from so many of our authors. The only way to get books out, either self-published or a small publisher who is not tied into the establishment, and there's nobody from the CIA watching what they are doing. You say, well, the CIA can't work in America. That's against the law. Well, if you believe that, you probably believe your Enron stock is coming back again are hanging on to it with that thought in mind. And the great tragedy is they're simply lying to the American people, and they have all along, but you don't have to worry. Now, of course, the CIA will be able to operate legally in America, doing what they have always done, and that is controlling the reality of the American people, controlling what the American people think. Craig, pick up the story from there.
Okay, but along the lines of the CIA not working in America, about 10 years ago, actually it's been 15 years ago now, I stopped a car going the wrong way in a one-way street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and pulled him over, and when I got up to him, he threw his CIA credentials on me and told me that I had ruined his tail. He was following somebody in Tulsa. So they obviously work inside the United States, because that man was, and he was in a CIA sedan with some kind of special radio and antenna in it that was company issue. It was not a rental car from the airport. So anyway, down to the 5,000 Iraqi terrorists. Oh, by the way, you know, he tried to impress me that he, you know, I'm CIA, and I said, well, I said, you can call Langley from the jail, or you can sign this ticket because you're going the wrong way on my streets. Anyway, during right after the Gulf War, there were thousands of Iraqi POWs that were taken and marched into Saudi Arabia and put into prisoner of war camps. Now, some of them surrendered and were more than glad to surrender. They didn't want to be in the trenches. They were draftees, didn't really want to be a part of the war, and they were very happy to see American troops and had wished that we'd crossed the border 3 or 4 months earlier so they wouldn't have to wait that long. However, there were a lot of them that fought against us that we actually did have to have some stand-up fights with, and one of them, of course, was the Republican Guards. Now, in Kuwait, you had the draftees that were in the trenches along the Saudi Arabian border, but when we did the end run around the west side of Kuwait and then came in behind Kuwait City into the Iraqi swamps, we ran into the Republican Guard. And when we see these photographs of all these burnt-out vehicles and buses and tanks and everything on along the road, that's the road from Kuwait City to Basra and then on into Iraq where the Republican Guard had fought and where they tried to get out. Well, we captured several thousand of these Republican Guard guys. And a lot of them, instead of being repatriated back to Iraq, were brought over to this country through, Madeleine Albright's State Department under the Clinton administration. And some of them even came over under George Herbert Walker Bush's administration previous to Clinton arriving. And they came through Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, and were resettled all over the country. And they immediately started getting into 8, 10, and 12-man cells and houses in such cities as Boston, New York, Miami, Washington, D.C., Dallas, Fort Worth. Oklahoma City had at least 2 cells. We had Tulsa had a cell, Denver, and I'm sure there's probably some on the West Coast as well. We know San Francisco had some, and Seattle, and probably Los Angeles as well, because they had a tendency to gravitate toward the larger cities. Now, these people that are coming across the border now have all these safe houses that they can go to. They're already here. They already know who they are. Once these people got into the country, they started going to local mosques. Now, they didn't go to mosques to pray. They went to mosques to contact other Muslim groups. And there are several Islamic terrorist groups operating inside this country besides Al-Qaeda. You've got Hamas, who's held massive rallies at mosques to raise money to send back to the Hamas and the PLO in the Middle East. You've got Islamic Jihad. You've got
Hezbollah. How about that?
Hezbollah. Right. You've got all of the PLO types that were hooked to Yasser Arafat, and then the follow-on groups that came afterwards. They're all in this country. They all come over here. They set up organizations. They set up mosques. They set up safe houses. They buy arms and equipment and send it back. They raise money all over the place, and they funnel it to supposedly charitable groups to help feed starving Muslims in the Middle East, and none of it goes there. It all goes into terrorist organizations. So these things are all here. These Iraqi terrorists are here. And we stumbled onto some of these when we were working the Oklahoma City bombing case, and we found out that there was between 10 and 12 Iraqis physically seen around the Oklahoma City bombing crime scene at the Murrah Building with McVeigh, with Nichols at different times, and in the truck with McVeigh, and along the route with the truck coming into Oklahoma City at various locations by witnesses. Now, there was a reporter for Channel 4 in Oklahoma City, Jana Davis, who at the time interviewed several of these witnesses and even took affidavits from them. And when she tried to present these to the FBI, when they were looking for John Doe 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, and so on, the FBI not only didn't want to see them, they refused to touch them. They didn't even want to have the box.
Because if they had it, they would have to then make that available to Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols' defense team. So they didn't want that information because they didn't want to have to turn it over. And the last thing they wanted would be that to be part of the public record.
Well, and they didn't want to be saddled with having to investigate it. They didn't want anybody to come along later and say, well, you had this information and you didn't follow up on it. Well, they can say, well, we didn't follow up on information we didn't have. We looked at it and we didn't see that it was going anyplace, no matter, it's the old deal of don't confuse me with the facts, I'm satisfied with the story the way it is. So She's right now sitting with all of this stuff. She tried to turn it over to David Shippers. He was interested in it. She tried to turn it over to other congressional investigators. But every time it looks like this information is going to go downrange, somebody steps up and debunks her, debunks the information, debunks me, or tries to. They can't, but they try. Or they simply ignore us, you know. So we're sitting here. We've got photographs of these guys. We've got eyewitnesses. We know who they were. There's videotape out there. There's all of this evidence. But no one wants to go there. And what's really interesting is we can hook Oklahoma City up through the Philippines to Osama bin Laden to Saddam Hussein.
And in fact, if you get Craig's book, and it was written about 98 or 99, somewhere in there, and he talks about this operation in the Philippines and Mohammed Osama bin Laden. It's one of the footnotes there. And of course, you have to understand that there was a direct tie-in of what happened in Oklahoma City to Mohammed Osama bin Laden or Osama bin Laden, but they can't let the American people know that any more than they can let them know they knew ahead of time. Carol Howe, who was actually a socialite, came from a very wealthy family, but you know, she had actually infiltrated the people at Elohim City. She was told about the plan to bomb the Murrah building, Kerry Gagan and others. The FBI knew that there was going to be a bombing, but they can't tell the American people because all those American people died. And if they would let the people die, 168 Americans die at the Murrah building, knowing there was going to be a bombing and doing nothing, and then covering up the fact that there were bombs inside the building as well as the one in the truck. Oh, how can we believe anything they tell us about what happened on September 11th? Because that incident is being used to take away our freedom and to justify the war with Afghanistan and to justify the war with Iraq. And heaven only knows what other wars will follow.
Well, federal law enforcement and federal agencies ascribe to the same old saying that the mainstream media does, and that's never let the truth stand in the way of a good story. And, if they had had to investigate the Oklahoma City bombing the way they should have done, or the way a lot of the agents wanted to, they knew that there were all of these leads that we gave them. They knew there were these rabbit trails that needed to be checked out. They knew there were these other people that needed to be picked up, and some of them they had enough information to put them in prison, take them to trial and put them away. But they weren't allowed to because their hands were tied out of the Janet Reno Justice Department. Now that's one problem. The other problem is the government never ever admits it's wrong. You have to take them to court and you have to beat them before they will ever admit they're wrong. Now you could look at the case of Ruby Ridge with Randy Weaver, where Lon Hariucci shot Vicki Weaver standing in a doorway. With illegal orders to open fire on any armed male that they saw, no matter whether they posed a threat or not, and so on. And Randy Weaver had to go to court and have a civil lawsuit before the government ever got caught. The judge finally said, "You're wrong. You're going to have to pay this guy." Otherwise, they would have never ever admitted anything. It's the same thing on just about anything you go up against the government with. They get a dozen U.S. attorneys and they sit there and they say, the best defense is a counterattack, and so they intimidate somebody that tries to go after the government, or they refuse to accept the suit in court, and so on. So now you've got a situation where the government never admits it's wrong. We're sitting here with all this evidence, all the stuff that we've tried to give them over and over again, even through congressmen and senators, and they still refuse to see it. Now, the interesting thing is this is precisely what they need to justify going into Iraq today, because we can tie not only Al-Qaeda into Iraq, we can tie the Oklahoma City bombing. We already had Ramzi Yousef tied into the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. Now we've got Ramzi Yousef, a guy named Edwin Angeles, and another one named Mohammed Wali Khan, who are working for the Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines, meeting with Terry Nichols on several occasions and giving him instructions on how to build bombs.
Now, this was in the Philippines.
This is in the Philippines.
Terry Nichols was over in the Philippines, and he was meeting with these Islamic terrorists who had these ties to Ramzi Yousef and, of course, indirectly to Osama bin Laden. So, but of course, they are not telling the American people that. And the question is why. You would think that they would try to use that to justify going into Iraq instead of saying they have the secret information, but we don't want, of course, Osama bin, but we don't want Saddam Hussein to know what we know about him.
Well, the thing is, it goes back to if they think they can go into Iraq without using this information, then they don't want to admit they were wrong in 1995 and 1996 and 1997 and so on, because they just don't do that.
Well, do you think they were wrong, or do you think they knew what they were doing and they did not want the American people to know about the Islamic terrorist movement until, of course, the it was the correct time? And the correct time, of course, was September 11th, year 2001. They knew about the Islamic terrorist movement. There was testimony before the Intelligence Committee. We have it listed in a book we carry called The American Jihad by Stephen Emerson. 1996, one of the Muslims went before the committee and said, don't you realize this whole Islamic terrorist movement is being funded from right here in America? And the Intelligence Committee knew that, and the FBI knew it, and the CIA knew it, and they did absolutely nothing. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why were they doing nothing when they knew the Hamas and Hezbollah and all of these radical groups which were plotting our demise were being funded in large part by, of course, the movement here? Of course, we know now, of course, the Saudi Arabians were funding it, and yet the administration is doing everything they can to block suits which have been brought against Saudi Arabia, even trying to block suits that have been brought against Saddam Hussein by the families of the people who were killed in the Twin Towers. Why wouldn't the government welcome those suits to bring out the truth? Or what are they concealing? And if there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing it?
Well, it's probably quite similar to, you know, we had a lot of things in common between Manuel Noriega and Osama bin Laden, some of the other terrorists in history, that they all at one time or another were funded by or worked for the CIA, which takes us right back in the same loop to the same company that put Iran-Contra together and all of these other things, and from the Bay of Pigs invasion to the Golden Triangle to you name it, and we keep running into the same people over and over. And when you read the Medusa file, there are several links that tie a lot of those cases together, and it's the same people over and over again, or the same money over and over again, the money laundering that goes on, the banks that go on, and so on. You just keep running into this. It's the one thread that ties them all together. You know, when we go back to the Vietnam years, we had all of these drugs coming out of the Golden Triangle that were coming down through Vientiane, Laos, and they're going through the Pepsi-Cola bottling plant, being converted from raw opium into 100% pure street heroin, then going out in five different directions, everything from Nguyen Cao Ky's Air Vietnam to the Corsican Mafia to Australia to Hong Kong and of course into San Francisco through Travis Air Force Base inside the body cavities of dead GIs. And all of this was being run as a CIA operation to finance the General Vang Pao against the Pathet Lao and warfare up along the Plain of Jars. Well, when the Vietnam War ended and we pulled out of Southeast Asia, this stuff kept coming out. And instead of 80 or 90 tons a year, it went to like 900 tons a year. And the banking complex that was set up at the time back during the Vietnam era was the Nguyen Han banking complex that was set up by CIA operatives and retired military personnel, which later, when it went defunct, when it was discovered in Australia, and the two people that set it up, one of them disappeared and the other one committed suicide out in the desert someplace, it was replaced by another banking complex out of Honolulu. When it was found out about, it just evaporated overnight, then we had BCCI replace it. BCCI was finally discovered, and they dispersed it to a lot of little banks around the world, especially inside the United States, where they could just wire money back and forth. And eventually, now they run it through the main banks in New York City, and they don't think anything about it. So
now you're basically, these are all CIA operations, aren't they?
Right? Every one of them.
And there's a great deal. In fact, Rodney Stitch has a book written, information he got from the fellow who ran the bank in Honolulu. The only trouble was that when it was uncovered, even though he was a CIA operative, they hung him out to dry and sent him to prison. His crime, he was doing too good a job, and of course they let him out. They sent him to 50 years, they let him out in a couple of years, and just told him to keep quiet, never to tell what had happened.
Well, Danny Casolaro was working on a book called The Octopus, where he's putting a lot of these things together, and he had all the names, and he had all kinds of records, and he had to meet with one more person in a motel room in Virginia, and the next thing we know, he was found dead in a bathtub. He'd committed multiple suicides upon himself, so to speak.
Right. I thought he was on the toilet seat. It doesn't really matter. But
he was actually in the bathtub.
He was actually in the bathtub. Okay. And, of course, an awful lot of people die under very strange circumstances. You know, you think about this happening on television. You don't think about it happening in real life in America today.
Right.
But it does.
And then changing gears very quickly, jumping back to these Iraqi terrorists inside the United States, we have something else going on now. We have Al-Qaeda that is claiming to have 7 nuclear warheads pre-positioned here. Now, whether they do or not, we don't know. But we found out that they could get them in very easily through the Costco shipping process. However, how easy would they be to obtain? Very simple. They just buy them from the Russians.
And the Russians, of course, are selling the things. The Russian commanders don't care. There's no morality over there. And, of course, they'll do almost anything to have money. They're not paying the military, and the officers, of course, will sell anything they have. I understand they're even selling tanks. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Colonel Craig Roberts. Well, Colonel Craig Roberts is with us, and go ahead, why don't you tell your concern about the fact that there really may well be some weapons of mass destruction in this country.
Well, you know, we've got the nuclear weapons, and people say, well, the Muslims are peaceful people. They would never use these things against us. They would never do such a thing. Well, if you go to their own press, in Cairo, the Cairo newspaper came out on January the 23rd and said that Sunni Muslim leaders have authorized Islamic states to acquire nuclear weapons. And the Islamic ruling committee in El Hazar, based in Cairo, ruled that the Islamic states must acquire nuclear weapons for defense. The committee is regarded as the highest authority for Sunni Muslims in the Middle East, according to the Middle East Newsline, and it has got a quote. It says, the acquisition of modern nuclear weaponry is a religious obligation, the committee said on December 23rd. This statement came in response to a question in Islamic law that was sent to Sheikh Al-Shawanwi, who said that the founder of Islam, get this, the founder of Islam, Muhammad, would have acquired a nuclear bomb to fight his enemies if he could get a hold of one. So,
well, I'll tell you what, now we know that Saudi Arabia has access to them because they put up the money for Pakistan's nuclear weapons, and Pakistan has them. And, of course, that country is so shaky. The only reason that it has not gone to the radical Muslims is because we are maintaining the dictatorship there. Under Musharraf, who we bribed with $1 billion of spending money. So, you know, the thing is that certainly it's only a matter of time before the radical Muslims, the Muslim extremist movement, which is growing because of what we're doing, and because we're maintaining dictatorships in their area, we're not allowing them to any freedom at all. We install the dictators, we keep them in power, and one of these days they're going to have nuclear weapons, and they may already have them, for that matter.
And it's very possible, because the Russians have been selling nuclear warheads from their missiles that they've been taking out of service to just about anybody that had the money to buy them. They're not cheap, but these guys have an unlimited supply of funding from the oil states.
Now, there was an article here, maybe about a month and a half ago. It was only on the Internet for three or four hours before somebody pulled it down. But it talked about nuclear weapons right here in America and the cells that they're... Are you acquainted with that article?
Yes, that's exactly what we were talking about with these weapons, plus the suitcase nukes that the Russian Spetsnaz had left behind. Those were all up for sale as well, and they were pre-positioned all over the country.
And, of course, the people have no idea what's going on. We're going to be back here in just a second. We'll wrap up the program. I wish we could go for 2 hours, but we've got a great program the next hour anyway. We'll be right back here with Colonel Roberts. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're on the last segment. Of course, we could go on. Craig and I have done a lot of two-hour programs together, and many times at the end of the 2 hours, while we're sort of sitting on, just have so much more to say. But we've only got about 2 or 3 minutes more, so what are the thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners this evening?
Right now, I think that people just ought to get ready for the worst because we're facing bioterrorism. These guys have got everything from plague to anthrax to smallpox. We don't know what they've got inside the country, but we know that they've smuggled some things in. We're just not sure what it is. At least the government may know, but they're not telling us. We've got food and water supplies that are targets right now. You need to have some way to filter water. You need to have some way to some food put aside so that there's a general panic in your vicinity if something happens, especially if we go into Iraq, that you don't have to run down to the store and worry if there's going to be anything on the shelves. Now's the time to start prepare. Medical supplies, keep your cars filled with gas all the time because the gas prices could shoot up overnight or even be cut off. We need to just start getting ourselves ready spiritually and physically to face hard times because I think they're right around the corner, Dr. Stan.
I agree with you totally, and of course this is why we tell our listeners, you know, they need to get Colonel Blaylock's book about how to build up their immune system because you have no protection against biological warfare other than your own immune system. That the book is, of course, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, or our interviews with him, and I agree totally. People should have those supplies on hand. We're probably in the most dangerous times I've seen in the 40 years I've been studying what's going on today. And the thing is, the average American says it could never happen here. The church, tragically, the Christian church, has convinced so many Americans that we're going to be raptured before anything ever bad happens to America. God would never allow anything bad to happen to America, would he? But tell that, of course, to the Christians in China, and the Christians of the Sudan, and the Christians in East Timor, and the Christians in Rwanda. So, Craig, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure, and we'll look forward to having you on again here in the near future because there's so much more we haven't even begun to cover this evening.
We'll be glad to be here back, and we'll be glad to be back too, Doc.
God bless you. Thanks so very much.
Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that, of course, is Colonel Craig Roberts, and certainly one of my favorite guests, and we've had him here many, many times, and if you've never heard his discussion of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the real story of Lee Harvey Oswald, and of course the real story of what happened on the in April 19th, 1995, the story of the Mirabilia bombing. We have all of these and so many more things that Craig has put out. And then, of course, his book, The Medusa File, is must reading. His book, Killzone, the Doorway to Hell, the true story of what Somalia was really all about, and the Black Hawk Down story. And then, of course, the book, The Dead Witnesses. Do you know there were over 100 people who were associated with the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who died under very, very mysterious circumstances? They all sort of just disappeared or died mysteriously. Could that happen in America? Ladies and gentlemen, we're dealing with dark and sinister spirits or forces. We're involved in a battle for the survival of Western civilization, and most people don't even realize that a battle is going on. So our plea to you is, of course, to simply become informed and help us inform others. And then please pray for America and pray, of course, for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back here on Monday. Until then, may the Lord be with you. So until Monday, when we'll be back with you, this is Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. And we're not going to take any callers the first half hour because we have with us Dr. John Eismo, and he's a professor of law at Faulkner University, constitutional law, and he's certainly one of the people who can best explain the background of the formation of this country and its godly heritage. Dr. Eismo, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, it's a pleasure to be with you, and greetings from Alabama.
Well, why don't you go ahead and just tell us, today when anybody talks about America's godly heritage, or, you know, anybody even talks about God associated with our country, we're told, oh, there's this wall of separation between church and state, and, oh, the president can talk about God and end his speech with God bless you, but we certainly could never have a teacher say that in the class today, or she'd lose her job. What's happened to America? What did America originate, and where did we go wrong?
Well, certainly America originated with the view that all law comes from God. The framers had studied very carefully, for example, Sir William Blackstone of England, Baron Montesquieu of France, John Locke and others, who believed that God was the source of all law, that any human law that was in conflict with the divine law as revealed in Scripture or as revealed in nature was invalid, that our rights are the gift of God, and we have one founding father of this nation who was probably less orthodox than some of the others, Thomas Jefferson, and yet in the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson recognizes that we are entitled to our independence by, as he put it, the laws of nature and of nature's God. And he went on to say that among the truths that this nation holds to be self-evident are that all men are not evolved, but created equal, and that they are endowed not by their government with certain negotiable privileges, but by their creator with certain unalienable rights. And that's the real foundation of this nation.
And it really is, the fact that it was because there was a creator who gave us our inalienable rights, then governments were instituted among men, deriving their certainly their power from the with the consent of the governed. But
exactly.
We seem to have gotten so far away from that.
Well, probably a good example of getting so far away from it, I can think of a couple of good examples, one from California and one from here in Alabama. In California, of course, I'm thinking about your Ninth Circuit's decision, the 2-1 decision recently, that under God does not belong in the Pledge of Allegiance, that it's unconstitutional to say it that way in a public school setting at least. And, of course, that ruling is on hold right now and is being reviewed, and we're, perhaps I should say, cautiously optimistic that it will be overturned. But there was a California state senator by the name of Tom McClintock who I thought made a fascinating and very insightful statement about that decision when he said that the drive to remove God from the Pledge of Allegiance and from other public references has very little to do with atheism. It has everything to do with totalitarianism.
I think that's really so true.
The phrase under God in the pledge stands in the way of an all-powerful state.
What was it that William Penn said? Those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants.
Exactly.
So how can we, of course, re-educate the American people? This, of course, the problem is that the average student, even the average person graduated from college, has no knowledge of our Constitution or the foundations of our freedom or our godly heritage. How do we reintroduce these concepts to a nation that has been so dumbed down they don't understand where we came from? And certainly they don't understand where we're going.
Well, that's a very good question. How do we do that? And I wish I knew the full answer to that. I guess I'd have to say that I think that has to be a battle fought on quite a few different fronts at the same time. And you are right out there on the front lines, Dr. Stan, with your radio program where you're reaching your listeners with the truth about America's heritage. And I like the way you began your program about how so often as we see in public life today, illusion is reality, and we're hearing the postmodern view, the New Age view, that there is no such thing as absolute truth. Well, good story that I heard about that recently was of a college professor who kept teaching that, he's a philosophy professor, that there is no such thing as absolute truth. Truth is whatever you want it to be. But he had a hobby, and his hobby was hunting mushrooms. And the observation is made that if he hunted mushrooms the way he taught philosophy, he'd be dead in a week.
And, of course, there is an absolute truth. Some will kill you, and some are wonderful eating.
It doesn't matter what you think it is. What matters is what it is in reality. But besides what you're doing on the radio, of course, we have what many of us are trying to do in teaching law. And at the law school where I teach, the Thomas Goode Jones School of Law in Montgomery, we state in our mission statement that we're dedicated to the fundamental proposition that biblical truth is the foundation of just law. And I'll be the first to admit, not all of our professors fully work out all the implications of that. In fact, none of us do fully, but at least we're working on it. We look about at people like Chief Justice Roy Moore here in Alabama, who has tried to educate this nation about the foundations by placing a monument with the Ten Commandments on them in the Alabama Judicial Building, and a federal judge, in response to a lawsuit by the American Civil Liberties Union and Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a liberal federal judge has ruled that that monument is unconstitutional. Now, see, something I find strange about that, and you might want to think about this, because this demonstrates the double standard that the court so often employs, and that's that right in front of the federal district court building where this trial took place, which is only a few blocks away from the judicial building here in Montgomery, Alabama, the federal building has a sculpture of the Greek god Themis, the Greek pagan god of law and justice. And this is pointed out to the court, but the court utterly ignored that in its ruling. Now, why is it okay to have a sculpture of the Greek god Themis in front of the federal building, but not the Ten Commandments in the State House? To me, it's kind of like what Joshua said to his people, choose you this day whom you will serve.
Well, I am told that the Supreme Court opens its sessions on a regular basis when the choir comes in and says, God save the United States and this august court's words to that effect.
They do, as do many other courts.
Then if that is true, how can the Supreme Court, start with an admonition to God or allegiance to God? And yet, of course, those same justices who sit beneath a marble beam that has a replica of the Ten Commandments on it say the Ten Commandments are wrong and prayer is wrong and mention of God is wrong. There's an inconsistency unless there is an agenda, and that agenda, of course, is to destroy the faith of our children, not of our justices, not of our congressmen, because their sessions start with a prayer, but they seem to have targeted the minds of our children.
Well, I agree with you that that is a double standard and an inconsistency. The explanation that they will give for this is that, first of all, the statement, God save the United States and this honorable court, is devoid of any real content. It's just what they call ceremonial deism. Well, I suspect our founding fathers saw a lot more to this than that. They saw the fact of God's blessing on this nation as being vitally important for this nation's success. And as far as the monuments to the Ten Commandments that exist in the U.S. Supreme Court building, you have one on the doorway, you have two of them in the Supreme Court chamber, although one of them is just a couple of tablets with Roman numerals 1 through 10 on them. And a few years ago, the tour guides that would take you through there would say that's the Ten Commandments. Now, in the last several years, they've been instructed to say that that's ancient law. In fact, one is even trying to claim it's the Bill of Rights. Well, I wonder why you see these figures with togas and so on holding the Bill of Rights. Then you have it also outside the judicial building on the where you see Moses holding these two tablets. They're beside him, Confucius and several others, but Moses is central and supreme. sitting down, Moses is a larger figure than any of the others around him who are standing.
Well, you know, of course, we're working with a lawyer, I'm sure you know, Mike Perutka, who is, of course, using your program on America and our Constitution to establish institutes of the Constitution all across America. And it looks like he's going to be up almost to 100 here in the very, very near future. Why don't you talk a little bit about what you tried to do and basically the theme of these 12 talks that you give, each one a half an hour, and yet they become the foundation of the institutes of the Constitution which are being established across America.
Well, when I first delivered this, the Institute of the Constitution, it was in Minnesota some years ago, and I had no idea it had become what's being done with it today. And Mike Perutka is a very, very gifted man of God, and God has prospered him in his legal practice, and he is using this, and I think not only is he using this, but God is using him in a remarkable way to get this out to the people. What the series does, though, it's a series of 12 one-half-hour lectures, and it begins with what law really is, the definition of law, why we should be studying law, why should we be studying history, what a biblical view of law is all about, what a biblical view of history is all about. It goes on into God's plan and the discovery and settlement and colonization of America and the formation of the American Republic. Then goes on to talk about the Declaration of Independence and analyze it, analyze briefly the Articles of Confederation, and then goes into what took place at the Constitutional Convention itself and the ratification debates when our Constitution was finally adopted. From there, we go into the Constitution itself, phrase by phrase, from preamble all the way to the ratification clause and on to the 27 amendments, what they say, what the founders meant by them, and what the courts have done with them or to them today. And then we close with a couple of lectures there dealing with how the biblical view of the framers that law consists of divine absolutes has largely been replaced today with an evolutionary viewpoint that law is whatever the state says it is, and the law is an evolving process, therefore. And finally, we close with suggestions as to how we can reclaim our republic. So that's what the series is, a series of 12 one-half-hour lectures.
Well, of course, how do we reclaim our republic? Because, of course, we have men who sat on our Supreme Court who did not believe in our Constitution, although they were sworn to uphold it, who used their position to violate their oath of office. And this, of course, is unconscionable. There is no way at all you could possibly interpret the First Amendment to say that we would take non-denominational prayers out of school or mention of God out of schools or the Ten Commandments. So all of this was done very, I think, maliciously, much of it done during the Vietnam War while our people's attention was diverted elsewhere. So how can we, of course, get people, first of all, to understand the Constitution and then, of course, reclaim our heritage, that is, our Republican form of government under God?
I think you're absolutely correct that that sort of thing is definitely not what the framers had in mind when they drafted the First Amendment. Primary author of the First Amendment was James Madison, and Madison had studied at Princeton under the Reverend John Witherspoon. He stayed there a semester after graduation so he could study Hebrew and read the Old Testament in the original languages. And when Madison introduced the First Amendment on the floor of Congress, it didn't say separation of church and state. That's a phrase Thomas Jefferson came up with some 14 years later. It simply says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and this part we sometimes forget to mention, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And I should add, too, that Madison also served on a congressional committee in that first Congress. And one of the things that congressional committee did was to establish congressional chaplains, to establish military chaplains, to establish days of prayer and thanksgiving, and Madison voted for all of these. And that being the case, there is no way he could have thought that this amendment that he crafted was going to have the effect of prohibiting prayer in public places.
Well, of course,
interestingly enough, the speech Speaker of the House at that time was the Reverend Frederick Conrad Augustus Muhlenberg, the first Speaker of the House and ordained Lutheran minister from Pennsylvania.
And of course, certainly prayer was never outlawed as far as Congress was concerned. You know, but how did they get away with, of course, taking the 14th Amendment and then adding a little of the First Amendment to that and then changing this? Certainly, when the 14th Amendment was passed, was there any thought on the part of the framers of that amendment that one day it would be used to alter our freedom of religion at the state and local level?
Well, Dr. Stan, I'll have to say that that is probably a debatable question. I don't think that was their intention. There is some evidence to the contrary, but first of all, I think maybe we need to explain what we're talking about here to our audience. The First Amendment and the Bill of Rights in general, it's very clear, apply only to the federal government. They were never intended to apply to the states. The language makes it very clear, Congress shall make no law. And the courts uniformly interpreted that way prior to the war between the states. And then right after the war between the states, we have this 14th Amendment, an amendment that provides in part that nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, for several decades thereafter, at well more than a half a century, the court understood that amendment to simply mean that no state may execute somebody that is deprive them of life or jail somebody, deprive them of liberty, or fine them, deprive them of property, without giving them a fair trial, due process of law. But gradually, in the 1900s, the court began to interpret that in a broader way to say that the liberty that we're talking about here includes the right of free speech, free press, free exercise of religion, the right not to have an establishment of religion, and the rights to abortion, and all these other things, and that the 14th Amendment, by applying that to the state, takes these amendments, or these rights found in the Bill of Rights, and by incorporating them into the 14th Amendment, applies them to the states. Now, I think the overwhelming weight of evidence demonstrates that that was not what Congress intended when they adopted the 14th Amendment. One thing that probably, I think, seals the nail in the coffin on that argument is that some years later, just a few years later, we have what we call the Blaine Amendment, a Congressman Blaine from up in Maine. I don't know whether they elected him because it rhymes or not, but Congressman Blaine proposed a constitutional amendment that would apply the First Amendment to the states. Now, why would he have proposed an amendment like that if he thought we had already done that just a few years before with the 14th Amendment? His amendment didn't pass, by the way, indicating that that's not what they thought they had done and not what they had intended to do. But while there is some possible dispute as to whether Congress intended that or not, when we look to what the intent of the framers is, we also look to what the states intended when they ratify it. And if you look through the various state debates on ratifying the 14th Amendment, you don't get any indication that any of them have the slightest suspicion that this was going to take the Bill of Rights and apply them to the states. If that had been what Congress intended to do, they could have said so in very clear language, and they didn't.
Well, you know, I think that there have always been those who really hated Christianity, and of course they would then be able to twist the words, as sophists always do, to give them altered meaning or to be able to argue a false point to make it reasonable. I had heard that, you know, at the time of the original debate over not whether we should have a Bill of Rights added to the Constitution, there were some people who opposed the Bill of Rights saying, look, if we even dare mention a religion there, I mean, it's a foregone that people have freedom of religion. In fact, we have a restrictive constitution. There's very little the federal government can do as laid out. But if we even mention religion, someday somebody's going to come along and twist the meaning of words to, then restrict religion. Is that true? I'm sure you know this far better than I would.
There were a few concerns in a few of the state ratifying conventions that this might be the effect. In fact, we have one man who was a very prominent delegate to the Constitutional Convention, Roger Sherman of Connecticut, He was an elder in the church pastored by Jonathan Edwards, Jr., and he assured that his Connecticut convention that this was not the case, that there had been no intention of doing anything like that. The discussion about the Bill of Rights that took place in the Constitutional Convention itself, some of the objections raised to a Bill of Rights, Madison said that a Bill of Rights was unnecessary, and the reason he thought it was unnecessary is that what we've established here is a government of limited and delegated powers. Government has only the power that we the people have delegated to it in the Constitution and no other. Now, we don't have to tell government what it can't do. It can't do anything that we haven't told it it can do. We don't need an amendment that says Congress may not establish a religion. Obviously, they can't establish a religion because we haven't delegated them any power to do so. And then Alexander Hamilton raised another argument about a Bill of Rights. He said the danger to a Bill of Rights would be that if we were to sit down right now, let's say for the rest of this program, and try to list all of our rights, do you think we could remember every possible right we have, the right to breathe oxygen, for example? And Hamilton is saying if we start listing them all, then somewhere down the line, some judge or some legislator or some governor is going to conclude that since we haven't mentioned a certain right in the Bill of Rights, we must not have intended to protect that right, and therefore that right is forfeited. And he said a much better way to protect human rights is to rely upon the common law tradition. And he had a valid point. But in the ratification debates, some of the anti-federalists, those who oppose the Constitution, like Patrick Henry, for example, one of their strongest arguments was the lack of a Bill of Rights. And so the Federalists, those who supported the Constitution, assured particularly the Virginia delegates that they'd immediately go to work on a Bill of Rights when the Constitution was ratified, and they did.
And then how easy it was for people who had a different agenda to twist the meaning of words, and then, of course, through the Commerce Clause, they were able to massively expand the power of the federal government, which was what our founding fathers feared more than anything. And, of course, those immortal words of Thomas Jefferson, in matters of politics, speak not to me of confidence in men, but bind them down for mischief with the change of the Constitution.
Exactly.
And, of course, it seems that they were just looking for an excuse, some little phrase in the Constitution they could use to increase the power of the state over the lives of the people.
And so much of this has taken place just kind of step by step. Maybe those who did so didn't really intend that it would ever go this far. For example, Chief Justice John Marshall, who in many ways I would call a great Chief Justice, but Chief Justice Marshall in the McCulloch versus Maryland decision rules that the power of the federal government to create a national bank, while it's not expressly mentioned anywhere in the Constitution, he says it's one of the implied powers. Now, you can understand his reasoning there, but to say that there are implied powers as well as express powers certainly opens up a lot of area for government legislation and regulation that they hadn't really thought of prior to that. Another decision, we have Gibbons versus Ogden, where the Supreme Court rules in regard to operating a steamship going across the Hudson River that navigation is a form of commerce and that Congress can regulate interstate commerce and that Congress's regulations over this area must supersede anything the states do. Once again, we see with one little step at a time, the authority of the federal government step by step being increased and the authority reserved to the states and to the individual being gradually curtailed.
And, of course, I've been in enough committee meetings and in politics enough to know that a lot of times you do things or people do things because, of course, well, it's expedient, it'll helpful, think of the good it's going to do, and they forget the principle. And, you know, as we see so many of the debates in Congress today, we find one congressman, he's known as Dr. No because he, first of all, is a doctor, and second, because he votes no, because what is being done is not constitutional, and most people go along because it's expedient and because, well, look at the good we'll do.
You're absolutely right. It's been said sometimes that imposed good is as dangerous as imposed evil, because even when, in fact, George Washington, this statement in his farewell address, He said that if, in any respect, the provisions of the Constitution are, in the opinion of the people, wrong, let it be corrected by an amendment in the way the Constitution designates. Then he went on to say, but let there be no change by usurpation. For though this may in the one instance be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. So often I think what we're seeing happen here from time to time is we see a national crisis, like maybe the drug crisis or the terrorist crisis and so on, and so government comes along and says, give us these powers, perhaps only temporarily, so we can protect you. And most people are willing to surrender their liberties in return for this kind of security or benefit, but they've established the principle that government can step in and violate the people's rights in this way, and that becomes a dangerous precedent for the future. We had a congressman, well, I was born in South Dakota, and I grew up in northwest Iowa, but we had a congressman in Iowa back in the 50s and 60s, and I don't know how much longer, by the name of H.R. Gross. He's a very conservative congressman. He once made the statement that if a congressman goes to Washington and does nothing but vote no, he will be right 98% of the time. That's about the way he voted most of the time, too.
Well, that's not very popular, you know, because, of course, what they do is they trade votes, you know, and then you can get somebody to vote to build a dam in your area, or to build a post office in your area, or to subsidize the manufacturers in your area. But every time you do that, of course, you're compromising your principles.
You know, I remember another very, very fine senator, Senator William E. Borah from the state of Idaho, one of the old conservatives of the early part of the 20th century. One time late in his career, he simply made the statement, in all of my Senate career, the votes of which I am proudest are no votes. Went on to say, I am proud not of good bills I have helped to pass, but bad bills I have helped to defeat. My highest claim for credit is not for the good that I have done, but for the evil I have helped to prevent.
I think that's really so well said. Well, I just wish we had more men like that, of that caliber, in our Congress and in our Senate today. Well, our guest has been Dr. John Eidsmo, and he's a professor there. Now, what is the university you actually teach at?
It's called the Thomas Goode Jones School of Law, named after an old Confederate war hero and governor and federal judge and so on. It's part of Faulkner University in Montgomery, Alabama.
All right. So I thought it was Faulkner University. Anyway, I want to thank you so very much for being with us this evening. I hope we can get you back at an earlier time, sometime in the future, when we can spend a full hour and really to explore all of these ideas and try then to get people to understand the magnificent Constitution we had, which is basically the foundation of our freedom, but it was based upon God and God's law. And once we take God's law out of a document, of course, we lay ourselves open for tyranny. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
I would just urge them to study the United States Constitution and understand that this is the charter, not that gives us our rights, but the charter that helps secure our rights. And understand that the principles found in the Constitution are valid principles because they are consistent with what we read in the Word of God.
And really, it's the Word of God from which inspired the men who created this great, great Christian nation. At one time, everybody knew it was a Christian nation. That fact seems to be forgotten today.
Absolutely. In fact, studies have shown that by far the most widely quoted source in the Founders' writings was the Bible. And next to the Bible, the most common sources were Christian writers.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us, and we look forward to having you back with us. And
I'd love to, Dr. Stan. You have a great program.
Good night. God bless you,
sir. Good night.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed having a Dr. John Eidsmo with us, and we'll be back here for the second half of the program in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we'll be back here in just a moment with the rest of the story, behind the story, here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, this is the time when we want to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do on a regular basis, 5 hours every day during the week, and then, of course, our weekend program, which goes to about 34 different stations. Now, admittedly, it's only half an hour, but you'd be amazed at how many people will design their whole day to have that half-hour information. And of course, many of those people then do eventually come to begin listening on the internet or listening on the shortwave. But we're on the shortwave 2 hours a day, on satellite 3 hours a day, on the internet 5 hours a day, and certainly on radio stations across America 5 hours a day. We just need to increase that, and our hope, our dream, is to begin to get this program syndicated. And if you notice, there's a little difference in the breaks that we're having and difference in the music, and this is because we're really making our plans now. I hope that in the very near future this evening program will be up on several satellites, and we can begin getting the various stations to agree to pull it down. That's a hope, and of course hope you'll pray that we can be successful, because we need to reach as many people as we can in the time that God has given us. So if you believe that there's a problem and you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we hope that you'll go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And, of course, there programs are archived. You can listen to the programs live, or you can listen to the archived programs, the Radio Liberty programs. Now, our American Freedom Network and our Genesis Network programs aren't necessarily archived at all, but we have many of the same guests on those programs that we have on the others, so you can get copies of those from the American Freedom Network or Genesis. The rest of the copies, if you'd like to get the programs, why, you get them right here at Radio Liberty. But please tell others about our programs and encourage them to listen, and hopefully as they begin to listen, they'll begin to change their perspective, and they'll hear things that they'll check out. They'll maybe call and say, I want to see the documentation of that. And we have the documentation on most of the things, and we're glad to get it out to you. They'll begin to read books. They'll begin to break the habit of sitting mindlessly in front of the television set, and they'll begin to do the one thing that our enemies of freedom fear most. They'll begin to think, and think independently. So remember our telephone number. It's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and of course, we don't have a guest the last half hour. Dr. Eismo could only be with us for a short period of time, and so we're going to have open lines, and if you're out there in the listening audience and there's something you'd like to talk about, this is the time to do it. And remember, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, you know, these are difficult times we're moving into. I was just going through some of the articles that we'll be filing away. I noticed that on one day, Dick Cheney said, we're going to have a terrorist attacks, a biological or chemical attacks in America. The very next day, Robert Mueller, who is the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, said, we're going to have biological and chemical attacks right here in the United States. Now, what do you think the chances are that two of our nation's leaders, two very prominent people, would make the identical statement on two successive days just by chance? And I'd say that it's about the same as your WorldCom stock going to 100 this weekend. It's just not going to happen. So somebody is coordinating a drive to convince the American people there's going to be a biological attack in America. And for a long time, I thought, well, they're just trying to scare us to death. And when you're scared, why, of course, you don't think, and you don't think clearly. And then, of course, as I begin to contemplate what's going on, I've come to another conclusion. I'm not absolutely certain of anything, but there are many unanswered questions. And you know, first of all, that when something seems to be incredibly stupid or there's no explanation for it, why, of course, there is an explanation. It just is so devious, it's very difficult for people to accept that as a possibility. And I shall have to admit that I was in the battle dealing with the AIDS epidemic for almost a decade. And when I wrote my book, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, in 1991, you know, I could not accept the fact that anybody could be using AIDS to bring about population control. And people would say to me often when I'd be speaking, and I really spoke all across the country, and there'd always be somebody put up their hand in the back of the room. Many times it'd be a black person, and they'd say, well, we heard that this disease was created to kill blacks. Where did the disease come from? And I'd always say, well, you're asking the wrong question. You ought to be asking not where did the disease come from, but why aren't we using effective public health techniques to stop this epidemic when we could so readily do that? We know how to stop epidemics, and we just haven't done it. Well, of course, I really wasn't smart enough to realize the answer to both questions is the same. Where did the disease come from, and why aren't we trying to stop it? The answer is, of course, the disease was created. It was a man-made disease, and we aren't trying to stop it for the same reason we created it, and that is to kill off a large part of the world's population. Well, we've got Mike calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi, Stan. Pretty good, and yourself?
Haven't heard from you in a long time. I missed you.
Yeah, life is crazy.
Okay, well, it really is crazy, but it's good to have you back.
Yeah. I really had hoped to talk with was it Mr. or Dr. Eismo?
Well, we call him, I believe it's Dr. Eismo, yeah. But it's John Eismo. Yeah. And we'd hoped to have him on for an hour this evening, but it's late. And actually, he is a second-degree black belt, and he's been off doing his karate training this evening. So I'm sure he was rather exhausted, and it's 11:30. So, yeah. But he really did a great job. Didn't you? Weren't you impressed by what he had to say?
Oh, yeah. I wish he could have gone on for the rest of the hour.
I wish he could have, too, and then I wouldn't have to worry about what I'm going to say. But you called and rescued me, so go ahead.
Well, we'll see how good a job I can do. I really wanted to raise an issue that I thought he might be expert in addressing. It's I don't know how to articulate this, but let me give it a try. I think there's a convergence. Okay, let me back up. He was talking about the problems these days we have with the Constitution and making it work. And I see the convergence of three philosophies or three areas of philosophical thought that are creating the problem. And it has to do, really, I think, ultimately with what might be called the New World Religion. We've been hearing for two or three decades now about such a thing as the Living Constitution. We've been hearing about social Darwinism, and we've been hearing about universal consciousness. And I think these three come together to create such a problem as we have these days, in that, number one, the living constitution apparently is something that changes. It grows and it adapts itself to the times, as it were. And then the social Darwinism that is really the antithesis of biblical concepts, in that since we have biological Darwinism, supposedly, where man is evolving up out of the swamps, etc. Man also is evolving socially into a higher and higher life form, supposedly, although we see very little evidence of that as we look around us. And then the universal consciousness, which brings us our concepts of so-called truth, which is quite opposite to biblical concepts of absolute truth. Universal consciousness says that since the human organism, being biological, intellectual, and spiritual, amongst other things, since the organism is evolving, then its concept or its ability to embrace truth, quote-unquote, is evolving, and so truth evolves. So we don't have absolutes. And so the Constitution has to be a living thing, and culturally we are an evolving thing. And so the Constitution, as it was established by our founding fathers, cannot continue as it was. Have I sufficiently confused everybody?
Well, no, I don't think you have, but of course, this is the sophistry that is used, first of all. These people who talk about this higher level of consciousness that we're evolving into, these, of course, are people who are in the metaphysical, these are people who are into spiritualism and into the dark side. And, of course, there is this conflict, as we've talked about many times. From the very inception of America, there was a Christian worldview, a Christian path, and then there was the dark side, there was the occult path, and there's been the conflict between them, between the Rosicrucians who came to America about 1640, and of course the Christians who came here really about 1620. We can't necessarily say that Jamestown was founded by Christians because it wasn't, but certainly the Pilgrims were Christians, and then soon the Puritans were streaming in here, and the Huguenots, and all the various Christian sects, but there was also the people from the dark side, and of course the Christians wanted to be free, establish a Christian republic under God.
Now, the people
from the dark side, though, wanted to take control of this nation, and is exemplified with that symbol on the back of the Great Seal, the pyramid capped by the all-seeing eye. You see on the back of the Great Seal, on the back of the dollar, and most recently on Admiral Poindexter's DARPA website, that occult symbol of the mystery religions representing using America to bring about the New World Order. So these two philosophies are in conflict, and of course one would use your argument about social Darwinism and the evolving Constitution, and those, the Christians would say no, the Constitution is permanent, it's built upon God's Word, and it can't change with the whims of men or simply with the passage of time, other than by the process of amendment.
Mm-hmm. You spoke of this original concept of freedom held by the Christians that founded this part of the world, the North American continent. What did they want to be free of, and what has this society actually bound itself to, as symbolized on the back of the dollar bill again? They wanted to be free of the system that they had broken away from in Europe, right? They wanted freedom to worship God as he is. But now we have the God who wants to destroy us, as symbolized on the back of the dollar bill.
Right.
I think that's so important for people to realize just what was the freedom that was being sought, and in what ways has that freedom been abrogated?
Well, they've changed the meaning of freedom. One time, freedom, liberty was limited government. Now freedom is a government that can provide for you from the cradle to the grave. And, of course, that exists in a prison, and, of course, the slaves had that sort of freedom. They use words and they distort their meaning. If a government can provide whatever you need, you are not free. Because government has nothing but what it takes from you by force, and then gives back with all sorts of strings attached that eventually strangle all freedom. So what we're doing is misusing words, and these wicked and evil people know exactly how to do that, and they have so many Americans confused, that believing that the only government can provide freedom. No, government takes away freedom. Liberty and limited government are synonymous. Tyranny and total government are synonymous. Our founding fathers recognized that. Tragically, the American today doesn't recognize that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, anything else you want to say, Mike?
I'm drawing a blank right now.
Okay, fine. Well, it's good to have you, and always look forward to your calls.
Yeah. Well, one thing comes to mind, the new Office of Homeland Security. We have... I've been looking through something that just came up in the last couple of days. It's the Homeland SS. I'm looking for my email now.
Jenny Soderman points out that this whole Office of Homeland Security sounds very much like the organization they had in Germany. It was almost the same initials, and it was to provide security for the fatherland.
Yeah. Give me just a second here. I can find something.
The Schutzstaffel, that was the term in German.
Yeah, the Homeland Security Specialist. This was on, I think, 60 Minutes, a couple of nights, Sunday evening. They're calling for volunteers, quote-unquote. You know, I believe this is Soviet-style volunteers now, to move into position. Now, this is requiring thousands and thousands of people nationwide to, I guess you'd call it, start a new career as a homeland security specialist. It's just very interesting that they have these two letters after the word homeland, homeland SS.
Yeah, it's Schutzstaffeln. It's a German phrase.
Yeah, well, right. There's a website, www.directoryofschools.com, homeland-security. That people could go take a look at and see what's going on.
Okay, well, thanks so very much, Mike. We're in real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
We just—that's got to be our job—is to reach people and let them know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks so much.
All right,
bye. But let's go to Diana, calling from Aptos. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Dr. Stan. It's Diana, and I'm right here in Aptos.
Right.
And I just want to comment on the music. I really don't care for the new music as much as I like the old music that you used to play.
Well, I appreciate your input, but let me tell you what's happened and why we had to change music.
Okay. The other one used to make me cry. I used to get tears in my eyes because it was so old-fashioned. And
I know. But basically, the federal government has passed a law.
Okay.
And this whole thing came about because there were some people up on the web and they were putting up all the music and people could simply pull it down, and of course ignore the copyright. So circumvent that, they passed a law saying that you could not stream on the internet any music that was pressed after 1972.
I see.
And then unless you had a contract, but there's no way to get a contract.
I see.
What they have done is they've complicated it so much that we had to go out and we had to buy music that had been specifically created by a company to use in here to abide by the law. So if you have a problem with the new music, and I know that I love the old rendition of America the Beautiful too, and I love Kate Smith's God Bless America. I'm trying, basically, if you know anybody who has an old record of Kate Smith singing God Bless America, get it for us. We'll copy it. As long as, she sang that back during the Second World War.
I'd love that.
If we can get that, why, we'll make a copy of it. And then we can play that on the Internet. But if it was actually pressed onto a record after 1972, then we can't use it. And so, write to Fred Samfar and complain about it. That's the end result. But don't tell him it's Radio Liberty.
No, I won't. I'll do a search for Kate Smith because I used to actually be in music myself, and I know a lot of other musicians, so I will try to find that for you.
You can find that Kate Smith, and we will make a copy of it, which we can do, legally, because, of course, we actually pay the people who make music to play it on KFER. But it's an entirely, we pay $500 or $1,000 a year just to play music on KFER, which we do. But we can't play it on the Internet. To try to circumvent getting into any problems, we've changed the music. I'm sorry you don't like it as well as the other.
I still love the show.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
God bless you.
God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, fine. Well, we'd like to know how you feel about the music. And, I love the music the way it was. Some people said, it's got to be more bouncy. It's got to be, But, Chris, our whole philosophy is, this is about America. This is about America as it was. This is about Kate Smith singing God Bless America. While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us pledge our allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful to a land so fair as we raise our voices in a common prayer. God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night, through the light of above. From the mountain to the prairie, to the oceans white with foam, God bless America, my home, sweet home. And I can remember in grammar school, we learned the words to that. We used to sing it, and that was, of course, during the Second World War. And of course, it was a rallying point for Americans. And so, if you can know anybody who's got one, an old record, or you've got an old record of the America, why, we'd be glad to have that, and we'll make copies and get the records back to you. And we can do that, but it has to be pressed after 1972, because of course we're, as you know, here on Radio Liberty, we're a little outspoken in what we do, and so we've got to keep looking over our shoulder all of the time. And we do the best we can, of course, to try to abide by the laws of the land, whether we agreed with them or not, because, of course, we are a nation of laws, and we can't be simply violating laws. There are better battles to fight than that. Our battle is, of course, to educate the American people the truth about what's going on. And so we hope that many of you out there will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family. We've got about 10 more minutes. So if you have a question or comment, you don't have to be bashful. Give us a call at 464-8295. If you're listening out across America, it's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, Dr. Stan, and of course, you notice where you have the breaks is a different time as well. And that, of course, is all making preparations to hopefully be able to get the program syndicated. And hopefully very soon we're going to have this program, our evening program, heard on, on at least two satellites. And then we hope that people across America will call their local station and say, hey, why don't you carry this program? Or if there's any way you could put together a little group locally to help the stations put it on. Some stations are owned by people who share our dream, who share our concern, and of course really realize that freedom today hangs like a thread as never before. Now, other stations are not going to put us on, but some stations will, and our hope is that we can find those stations and or networks, or Christian networks, or a network like, of course, the American Christian Network, which puts us on from 8 to 9 every evening on their four stations up in Oregon, and they cover all of eastern Oregon, the Spokane area, and the Tri-Cities, and Wenatchee, and really we're so grateful to be on that network. And, very minimal cost to us, and minimal cost we can afford of the expenses of being on someplace in Los Angeles or New York City or others become almost prohibitive for a small ministry such as ours. But it's been amazing to see how we've grown and how God really has put it on people's hearts to give sacrificially and help us, which has allowed us to begin to get to the point of almost breaking even, which we're not complaining. We love what we do. And we feel that when freedom is lost, why, everything else is going to be lost. And I will tell you that we are moving rapidly towards an all-powerful authoritarian society, and it is being justified by, of course, the threat of terrorism. And yet, of course, if you go into the background of who financed the Mujahideen, who financed the Al-Qaeda, who financed the Taliban, we did. Just the same as we've been financing the wicked dictator of North Korea by sending massive food supplies to feed his army and massive oil supplies to keep his army and industry going. We have been subsidizing the North Vietnamese, who are building nuclear weapons to threaten us. And if you think that doesn't make sense, well, it makes about as much sense as the fact that we build up Adolf Hitler's military potential. We financed the communists in Russia. We lent them money. We gave them the technology. And if you've never read Professor Sutton's Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, that three-volume set, it's still available in print at Hoover Institute. Really, it is must-reading, or we simply carry the one book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, which gives so much detailed information on the background of the Bolshevik Revolution. And if you haven't read my book, Brother Little Darkness, and of course there we actually quote from Bruce Lockhart's book, British Agent, and he actually tells how he has been sent to Moscow or whatever, because they called it St. Petersburg, and eventually it probably became Leningrad, but St. Petersburg by Lord Milner. And of course he is to report back on what's going on in Russia to Lord Milner. And of course, he doesn't know anything about the secret society that Lord Milner heads, the secret society that Cecil Rhodes had created. But he remarks how strange it was that he and another gentleman who represented a man named Thompson from the Federal Reserve Board, Leonard would always call them in and consult with him before he made major decisions. And when the Central Committee of the Politburo of the Communist Party was getting together, they would invite Bruce Lockhart and the American to come to sit in and give them advice. And when the American, had a fight with one of the Russian dignitaries or heads of one of the chief communists, he called Lenin and told him he wanted the man fired, and Lenin asked if it would be all right if the man was transferred to another city. And, of course, the man said, well, since he couldn't have him executed, why banishing him to the other city was the best thing possible. And so he agreed to let Lenin banish this man who was running the Soviet Union. And you have to ask that. You read that passage in the book, British Agent. You know, many years ago I went out and I just went to bookstore after bookstore after bookstore, and I figured if I got all these books, somewhere in them there'd be truth. And, of course, we came across these books, and we collected them, and then, of course, we read Professor Quigley's papers, and he listed a number of books about the secret societies, and we collected them all. And then a book came out that listed all the books, and then we actually sort of never really were organized enough to know what we had, so we went out to buy these books, and that all disappeared. Well, I didn't realize that I already bought them, but they were not available. Somebody was buying them up, and, of course, they were simply disappearing, exactly as the book, 10,000 Famous American Masons. You can't get a set of those anymore. And, of course, it names all the people in Masonry up until 1960, presidents, governors, Supreme Court justices. I mean, they dominated, of course, America. You try to get to used bookstores and searches, 10,000 Famous Freemasons. The last time, when I first tried, there was one for $250. I waited 24 hours before I called back to say I'd taken it. It was already bought, and to my knowledge, there's never been another one available on the Internet. If you can find one, I'd love to get it, because I think it's so vitally important. You understand that there really are these people out there, and they're working behind the scenes. And it's not just the Masons. It's not just the Council on Foreign Relations. It's not just the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission, or the Hierarchy of the Rosicrucians, or the Theosophists of the Lucius Trust. It's all of them working together with the bankers and the people of great wealth and the great tax-exempt foundations. Their goal, a new world order, a new world religion. And so, of course, eventually we begin to see how these people have helped communism. We created the best enemy money could buy. And then, of course, the time came when communism was to fall. First time we ever saw a revolution on American television, and all, of course, all the speakers speaking in English, or so many of them speaking in English, gee, wasn't that nice of them, so we didn't understand what was being done there. And, of course, I remember when in the middle of the revolution, and they brought in some people from the army that had been sent to put it down, but the army units weren't given any ammunition for their guns. It was all as phony as a $3 bill. And then, of course, we began to see Gorbachev, who is deposed now, coming and taking over possession of the Presidio, and, of course, meeting with Stephen Rockefeller and Marie Strong, and drawing up the new Ten Commandments for the West, for the world, called the Earth Charter. What's wrong with this scenario? Here's the former dictator of Russia, former head of the Soviet KGB, cavorting all over America, getting $100,000 for a speech, financing this movement, because behind communism is another force. Well, we're out of time. So until Monday, when we're back with you, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Oh, Dr. Stan, until Monday, we will be with you once again. May the Lord be with you.
Can I understand you have a final with you? What's his name? Sweetie.
Sweetie? I can't make sense.
Anyway, I have a friend in Kauai that gave me this book. I'm wondering if you have it.
What is it?
It's by Manly T. Hall.
Oh, what is it? Secret People of Kauai?
Yes.
I do. That's one of my favorite books. I don't have it in hardcover, and I don't have it in color. Is that one in color?
Well, this isn't in color, but it's the silver anniversary of it, in the original size.
It's one of the most important books in my library. And yours is much better than mine.
Right here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this lays out the whole thing. It tells about the voice of Christ. And this whole thing, isn't that? Have you had a chance to go through this?
No one can.
This is.